From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is one that has not yet been made, but for a moment I want you to imagine it. Imagine a United States that has just passed a mandatory gun buyback law. Not all guns, not most guns, not even close. This law is a buyback of a certain kind of weapon that fires many rounds per minute. The law in this imagined future says that you can still stockpile all kinds of handguns. You just can't own weapons with bullets that do significantly more damage to victims fired at higher rates of speed with high-capacity magazines. Is this a sacrifice that gun owners should make? Well, a growing number of Americans say yes, and some Democrats running for president argue that it's time to ban and buy back. That is a form of confiscation that would be enforced by the government. But many gun owners argue that this kind of policy would itself be an act of violence against the gun-owning population. This hour brings a libertarian perspective to the gun policy debate that some of our listeners said was missing last week when we talked about this. So let's welcome our guests who are in studio with us. Sean Phelan is the Monroe County Representative to the Free Libertarian Party of New York and co-host of Rochester's Liberty Talk Hour on Rochester Free Radio. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. Privilege.
And also with us is Andrew Hollister, who is a small business owner, outdoors enthusiast. He is a former candidate for lieutenant governor with the Libertarian Party, among others. Nice to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by listening to a bit of sound that sparked some of the discussion last week and that I think will at least help inform why the discussion nationally has focused on call it confiscation, call it a buyback, etc. This was from the recent Democratic presidential primary debate hosted by ABC News, and this is the question and answer to Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
I do want to come to Congressman O'Rourke because I know this is personal to you. El Paso is your hometown. Some on this stage have suggested a voluntary buyback for guns in this country. You've gone further. You said, quote, Americans who own AR-15s and AK-47s will have to sell them to the government, all of them. You know the critics call this confiscation. Are you proposing taking away their guns, and how would this work?
I am. If it's a weapon that was designed to kill people on a battlefield, if the high-impact, high-velocity round, when it hits your body, shreds everything inside of your body because it was designed to do that so that you would bleed to death on a battlefield and not be able to get up and kill one of our soldiers. When we see that being used against children, and in Odessa, I met the mother of a 15-year-old girl who was shot by an AR-15, and that mother watched her bleed to death over the course of an hour because so many other people were shot by that AR-15 in Odessa and Midland. There weren't enough ambulances to get to them in time. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
That's Beto O'Rourke, and you heard the reaction in the hall there, but a very different reaction among a lot of American gun owners, so I'll start with Sean on this one. When he talks about, and I think we should call it confiscation, I'm comfortable with that term, that a forced buyback means that it's not optional, that's a form of confiscation, but what he's saying is not all guns, but the kinds of guns that have those kinds of rounds that do that kind of damage at that level of speed, he says that the law ought to change. How do you characterize that proposal?
Out of touch. He's out of touch with the Constitution.
With the Constitution?
Yes. It clearly states no infringement of the Second Amendment rights on your right to bear arms. And the right to bear arms is not anything about hunting or anything like that. It's about standing up to tyranny. And people will say, well, you can't stand up to the government, you know, with just, you know, some AK-47s or some M16s, AR-15s. I think you might want to try telling that to the Vietnamese. They certainly did a great job in stopping us from doing that with just that. They stood completely up to us, and they really handed us our hat in Vietnam.
I'll turn to Andrew, and then we've got a lot of ground we're going to try to cover this hour. Listeners, if you want to join, how do you characterize the proposal from Congressman O'Rourke?
So I have a lot of questions, and he's not here to answer them. You know, I think the thing that everybody should ask themselves first is, well, what's high velocity? What's a lot of damage? What is, you know, some of the ways he characterized things as somebody who's interacted with firearms my entire life, done an extensive amount of training, weren't actually accurate statements. So I think the first thing that we need to do in this conversation is, especially in politics, stop trying to take the language out that incites emotion and talk about what we're really talking about. You know, is high velocity 900 feet per second? Is it 3,200 feet per second? Are all of those, you know, a BB gun can shoot now up to 1,300 feet per second mm-hmm. with air. But, you know, a 45 handgun might only shoot at 900 feet per second. So that right there is missing from the conversation. What constitutes, you know, all of those things? I think that there's a lot to be talked about. And I listened to the other show. I liked the fact that a lot of people mentioned, hey, everybody should be a part of the conversation. But when we come up with legislation, we actually need to talk to the experts. And clearly that's not happening. That's not happening in this, you know, in this arena. It's not happening in healthcare. It's not happening in a lot of things.
I suspect it drives gun owners a little nuts.
Yeah, the people that are knowing the least about something are making the decisions for things that they have no idea what they're talking about.
The actual legislation, I think, has to be drawn up by experts. I think we should at least set that as a baseline.
Absolutely.
And I think you're making good points. Yep. But Andrew, when you draw that distinction, which is an important question, what do we mean by high velocity? I can hear to the extent there's another side that wants more stringent laws saying, well, fine, let's talk about that. But even if we define that, are you going to then argue the libertarian position that no matter where you define it, you don't get to ban it?
I very well might.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
And actually, I'll bring up a court case that happened in the Supreme Court, 1939, United States versus Miller, where they actually tried to restrict the Second Amendment to only weapons currently used by the military. And that decision actually came through at that time where they said the Second Amendment is for weapons in common use for the military, so you could only own military weapons. So it's interesting how the conversation has changed. That was 1939. We have more recent court cases. We could talk about those later.
Sure, and Heller comes up a lot. I mean,
the notion of
common use comes up a lot. Mm-hmm. But I think in the recent editorial or the recent opinion piece for the New York Times written by, I guess I can call him a former libertarian, Will Wilkinson, who used to be at Cato and now he's at the Niskanen Center in Washington. His argument is that everybody in the gun debate seems to think they know exactly what the Second Amendment actually means and that only their view is the correct one in what was obviously a poorly written amendment to begin with that has been debated for decades and now centuries, and we should have some humility and say, this is what I think the Second Amendment says, but maybe I'm wrong. I mean, do you concede that you might be wrong about the Second Amendment, Andrew?
About what I think it means or what the Supreme Court says it means?
Sure. Well, I mean, all of those things.
Well, you know, as of today, I mean, the Supreme Court is the law of the land, and how they rule is how things are going to be prosecuted. So are they wrong in their rulings? I mean, based on the rulings I've seen, I feel like they've ruled pretty correctly. I think a lot of people misinterpret the Second Amendment, but not necessarily in terms of the language. That happens all the time. I think people misinterpret the purpose of the Constitution and the purpose of the Second Amendment. The purpose of the Second Amendment is not to give you or me the rights to bear arms. It's not to tell us what guns we can and cannot have. It's to place a restriction on the government and tell the government what they cannot do and what they cannot restrict from the citizens. And a lot of people have that the other way. They think it allows a certain amount. No, it places a limit on the government and what they can do and restrict.
Okay, fair enough. And so let me turn to Sean because I see you nodding with this. And I'm going to draw up a scenario that I think probably Sean and I will maybe have some disagreement here, but I hear this invoked a lot. So let's do this. What's invoked a lot is, well, hey, you shouldn't be allowed to own a surface-to-air missile, right? You shouldn't be able to own a rocket launcher, right? So if you agree with that, then we're just arguing over where the line is.
Why not?
Oh, so
I'm just asking why not.
Okay, hold on. Usually what happens is I get told, well, that's a disingenuous argument.
It is. So that's why I'm kind of giving you one back.
Okay. All right. So, but do you think it is a disingenuous argument?
Slightly, yes, because those aren't like weapons that are like readily available. That's not like something.
Well,
you'd
we can make them readily available. There's lots of companies that would be thrilled to make the money to make those readily available.
I'm sure they do. But the thing is how you're not going to make them like affordable to the common man. I mean, there's a place out in Ohio you can go to where they own tanks. I mean, you can go for a ride in a tank, and I think they even do a live fire.
Yeah, no, I hear that. How much does, and again, I know this is another thing that gun owners and gun enthusiasts get frustrated with, because when we say AR-15, we're really talking about a platform that can do a lot of different things. But typically, when we talk about an AR-15, an AK-47, how much do you need to spend to get one?
Those happen to be mass-produced items that are easily available. I'm sorry?
How much for one?
I don't own a gun.
I'm not in the market for one.
Yeah, I know the market pretty well. So if you want to get maybe a lower end AR-15 platform, you could start at $600 probably.
Okay, so that's not that affordable to most people anyway.
Yeah.
And you don't think we can get a rocket launcher down around the $1,000 range? We can mass produce those.
Oh, I'm sure you could.
A small one.
And I would actually jump into the conversation and not to sound like an extremist, hopefully I don't. The intent of the Second Amendment, and I've got the Federalist Papers here in front of me, written by James Madison, who drafted the Bill of Rights, and also Alexander Hamilton, somebody who was very well involved in putting this together. And they both actually state, this is actually before the Constitution was written, that their intent for the populace is for them to always be more powerful than the federal army, and to have access to the same weapons. Now, that's kind of saying it in common language today, but that was the intent of the people who wrote this.
And this is where I think, number one, I'll grant that point, and I think it's a fair one, and I think it's an important one in context, to understand that at the time, you had a citizenry distrustful of government. And by the way, plenty of citizenry today
probably
is distrustful of government.
I'm talking about
the time. And understanding that if they could be more heavily armed, that they could prevent the kind of tyranny that they had seen, not only the crown, but also around the world. They probably were not imagining nuclear weaponry. And I'm not saying that to be flip, but if the idea is the citizenry is always supposed to be more powerful, then that's an argument to actually put nukes in the hands of the civilians. And I think we are in a different time, are we not?
Or an argument to reduce the size of government and limit the wars we're involved in.
Exactly.
And limit nuclear stockpiles?
Sure.
Eliminate nuclear stockpiles?
As a goal? Some things are set as goals that you don't ever intend to reach that goal, but you strive to.
It's not a goal then.
Well, no. You do strive to it, because we strive to have a democratic republic here in the United States. And we're not there, but we strive towards that goal.
Mm-hmm.
And freedom, for example. That's a goal that we're all supposed to be striving for, except here, apparently, in New York State, where we're ranked last. But it's something that you continually try to attain. I try to become a better person every day. I try to be a better person, and therefore, it's not exactly a goal that's attainable. I can't say that's it. I've reached the goal. I'm a better person now. And I don't have to try again tomorrow. So this is an ongoing process, and I think that's what people kind of overlook.
I think that's an interesting point of view, because this, in the gun debate, sometimes libertarians are sort of painted as being on the right. But interestingly enough, when we talk criminal justice, when we talk about foreign policy and war, libertarians are not exactly where the modern conservative, or especially neoconservative, movement is at all. So the Venn diagram sort of shifts a little, and I do find that interesting. But I want to hit this point so I fully understand it, because I think that's important. Sean, when you say a surface-to-air missile is not in common use, it's way too expensive, most people cannot get their hands on one. It's very different than a common platform like an AR-15. It's true. But there was a time where that was exactly the case for an AR-15, that it wasn't in common use, that the military had a few, that it would be massively expensive, and it wasn't commonly produced. So if we were sitting here generations ago and people said, well, we should make AR-15s, and you could have said, well, look, that's wild. AR-15s are not commonly used, but now they are. So in the future, if more powerful weaponry, a surface-to-air missile, becomes more commonly used and mass-produced, should the citizenry be allowed to own it?
Well, I'm all for fighting fire with fire, but you do realize, like, the AR-15 had predecessors too, right?
Sure.
I mean, there was the M4 Garand. Before that, I believe it was the Springfield rifle, which was standard issue.
Sure, but
going all the way back.
At one point, it wasn't much of a standard issue. At one point, it was a revolutionary and rare thing.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
Yes.
So in the same way that we don't see commonly used surface-to-air missiles in our backyards, if we get to that point, should they be commonly allowed to be purchased and owned?
On paper, I don't see a problem with that. I really don't. You're kind of making faces at me a bit here, because
I'm digesting it. I'm actually appreciating the intellectual honesty that you're bringing to this argument, consistency.
I'm not going to, but I'm
digesting it.
Yeah, I'm not going to, you know, fake it here. I'm going to tell you how it is.
Sure.
And I don't see there being a market for it until there's a need for it. And once there's a need for it, then you'll see a market for it. So that's why the common person isn't, you know, needing to, you know, go and figure out how do I get my hands on a Stinger missile?
Okay.
You know, how do I get my hands on an RPG?
Sure, sure.
You know, how do I get, you know, there's not a need for it.
So what's the need for the AR-15? What's the need for the AR-15?
To home protection, personal safety, defend yourself against an oppressive government.
Yeah, I think the last one makes the most sense to me if you're actually thinking about government.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But home protection you can't do with a .22?
Ah, I'm so glad you said that, because I brought in some samples for you, okay?
Oh, boy.
Is the .22 you're talking about defending your house with, which is this little one-inch long, thinner than a pencil, little bullet. This is the round that the AR-15 uses, much larger, about 2.5 inches longer, about the thickness of a pencil. The diameters are just about the same, down to the thousandths of an inch, but clearly you can see the amount of gunpowder in the cartridge, the brass part. Much significantly different items.
The .22 kills thousands of people a year.
Usually due to accidents.
You don't think people are using the .22 in...
home defense? No. Not at all.
I don't think most people who use anything in home defense are successful with guns in home defense, but... I mean, there's a handful of cases a year where people will defend a home with a gun.
Handful?
Yeah.
There are a lot more than a handful.
There's a handful.
No, there's a lot more for the handful, sir.
Thousands. There's a lot of contested numbers. I would say for sure the numbers are contested to be significantly more defense. I don't know about specifically in your home or not.
Okay.
Than crimes committed.
Absolutely.
And the problem with those numbers are... They don't get reported the same way. It's very easy to go to like the CDC and look up deaths. If nobody's prosecuted, it's not recorded as a crime. The media is not really in favor of reporting this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't have exact numbers, but I have seen some articles, especially in the the criminology department out of Florida. I think Florida University. They had some pretty interesting articles from their professors, like put together scholarly articles that basically said that the numbers are so significantly skewed, mostly by media reporting the data, misinterpreting it, not putting in a lot of factors. So I wouldn't say one way or another, just because the information doesn't seem to be clear.
Okay, but what Sean's answer to my question included, why do you need an AR-15, is for home defense, and you want something more powerful.
You need something to match fire with fire. Okay, most likely a criminal today is going to enter your home, and if they do have a handgun with them, it'll most likely be a 9mm, which is quite larger than what I just showed
you. It's what we more call a mid-size.
I'd call that bigger than mid-size.
Okay,
but
the point is...
I'm an ex-Army infantry soldier, so
okay. But a 9mm is much stronger than a .22, no question.
Yes. But my point simply is you want to match fire with fire, and an AR-15 is much simpler to operate. It has relatively no kickback whatsoever. While a 9mm, if you don't grab it hard enough, it'll jump right out of your hands.
Now... this is where I think it's important to ask, do you acknowledge the data, and there's a lot of data out there showing that if you have a gun in your home at all, it is more likely to be used in a way that you don't intend, tragically. Suicide, accidental usage, domestic violence, etc., versus successful home defense. Do you acknowledge that?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But you're...
And if you take the guns away, they'll just replace them with bats or knives or whatever else they can get their hands on. I mean, look at what's going on in England right now. Sure, they banned the guns. Now they have a huge knife problem, you know? They have a huge bat problem now.
So one thing I'd like to jump in on is I think the conversation's maybe going in a direction that doesn't really help the conversation.
No,
and the reason I'll say that is often what comes up is, well, how do you justify the ownership of personal property? And does society deem ownership of what you think is right to defend yourself adequate? And I see that a lot. So a lot of times, well, what's your reason for owning an AR-15? Why do you need an AK-47? You know, those type of questions are really just asking somebody to justify their preference in defense and their ownership in personal property. So I don't think those are the questions we should be asking. I think the questions we should ask are actually two questions that we often ask people to ponder to see if they're libertarians. So the first question is, when you're shopping at the store, when you're at Wegmans, the mall, you know, you're at the park walking your dog, and you see the average person walking by, you know, looking at the cost of cereal, do you think that in general, the majority of people are good people? Or do you think that they are inherently bad people? That if murder wasn't illegal, if theft wasn't illegal, they would rob Wegmans clean. They would take the shirt off your back. They would shoot you, break into your home if it was legal. Or do you think that inherently, naturally, the people at the store are going about their daily lives? They don't want to bother you. You don't want to bother them. Acknowledging that there are bad people, but it's not the majority. And you don't have to answer it, but it's
well, that's an easy one for me.
Okay, so let's hear it.
I think it's very obvious that people are generally good.
People are generally good.
I think we are way too scared.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, yes. Fellow people.
Yep. Yes.
So I think people are not likely to break into your home.
Yep. So right. that's the first question. The next question that we often ask is, you know, in terms of you, your life, your job, your finances, your family, who's in charge of being responsible for that? Is that you? Should you be managing your finances? Should you be responsible for the upbringing of your family? Should you be the one working hard to acquire skills to get a job and then find the job? Is that your responsibility or is that the government's responsibility? And once again, you don't necessarily have to answer, but it's for you and for the listeners to think. And if you think that, yeah, I'm the one responsible for that, and you think that people are inherently good, then chances are you're on the path to libertarianism. And, you know, if you believe that people are generally good, then you also probably believe that when you own a firearm, it's for your personal enjoyment. It can be for defense, and it can be for defense against tyranny. But you also believe that in general people are good, and hopefully you would never need that. No different than a fire extinguisher next to, you know, your stove. You know, you hope that you never have to use that fire extinguisher. And when you go to the store, I bet you're going to look and you're going to see the little tiny canister, maybe a midsize and a large one, and you're going to assess, well, the level of danger I would feel with a fire in my home, which of these do I think is going to best protect me so I can put this fire out?
Yeah, okay. I mean, I see where you're going with that. I think the rejoinder is this. You can believe all of those things about our fellow human beings, and you can think that people are generally good and that people want to be left alone and that people want to be respected to have their own property and to live the life that they want. And I think I understand as libertarian ideals exactly where you're going with that. You can also decide that there is some small category of things that people can own that in the case of an accident or a theft or a problem can do such undue damage that, I mean, like if I said, look, I own a tremendous amount of acreage out west. Our family has lots of money. And if I want, I ought to be able to blow off a nuclear weapon there because I've got enough acreage. No one's nearby.
No,
and that's mine.
No, sir. That's the fallout would endanger others, and therefore that's against libertarian principles.
Smaller weapon. Smaller. I've invented, you know, it's like a quarter-size nuke. You know, so it's my property. Don't tell me what to do with it. And
okay.
Now someone steals it, though, and you can take out half of a city and 100,000 people in a blink of an eye, then I think at some point you could say, yeah, most people are good, and you should be left alone. But there are certain things that if you own, we have to assume that in a population of hundreds of thousands of people who are gun owners, some non-zero number are going to be loose with them. And when they end up used or lost to the people who are going to do harm, we are in real trouble. And our kids are in real trouble. So therefore, we're going to regulate them. I don't think that that's entirely inconsistent with a basic, basic classical liberalism.
But the problem is that these laws are being designed, these gun laws are being designed to go after the good people, not the bad people. And the bad people with guns are going to continue being bad people with guns. They don't follow the law from the beginning, so no law is going to change their mind about how they're going to behave, even if you want to do a buyback.
I think it's important to reiterate, murder is illegal already. Theft is illegal already. Just like rape is illegal already. Assault, you know, all of these awful, terrible things that happen in society done by a small percentage of people who are genuinely bad people or people in a very desperate situation. All of those things are possible. But we can't sit there and go, you know what, we're gonna just start banning things because we think that maybe it will make things safer. And I'll give you an example. You know, you brought up, you know, safe storage, people loosely storing firearms. Well, what do you think the probability is of you dying by a car accident? 1 in 77. Of all the ways that you're gonna die, you have a 1 in 77 chance of you dying in a car accident. What do you think the chances of you dying in a mass shooting are? Actually, before I do mass shooting, let's go to
definition of a mass shooting?
I can answer that.
Yeah.
But let's talk about your chances of dying while interacting with law enforcement.
Mm.
That is 1 in 7,000th of a chance. Your chance of dying in a mass shooting is 1 in 11,000th of a chance. So we're talking about things. We're using a really emotional response, especially because you have a higher chance of dying in the custody of the people who are there to protect you, which is law enforcement. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for law enforcement.
You're just looking at the numbers.
I'm just looking at the numbers. But I want to make sure the listeners understand, because sometimes libertarians can be skewed as like anti-law enforcement. So I want to make sure that's clear. So if that's the case, and we're looking at something like automobiles, you have 1/77th chance, whereas mass shooting, you have 1 in over 11,000th of a chance. Why aren't there safe storage for keys? Why aren't we looking at things that are actually harming people? You know, I think congestive heart failure, you have a 1 in 6 chance of dying of that. We're talking about an emotional issue here, not an issue that is truly... It's an issue that's very important. And I think when we talk about numbers, sometimes we lose the emotion and the importance and value of human life. And I want to make sure that's really clear that I'm not looking at this and saying human life isn't important or that it's not valued or emotional. But what I am saying is, statistically speaking, we're talking about what would be considered an anomaly.
No, I understand.
But Andrew, the kids, Andrew.
And the kids are important, and everybody cares and values for the kids and the children. But
of
the
course.
Fact is, more children are dying from keys not being locked up from cars than
now,
firearms.
I also understand the point you're trying to make when you can't just ban something and then everything gets changed or is different or better.
Well, plus when you ban something, you create a black market, and right there you track crime.
Sometimes when you ban or use regulation or change the law, things can get better. You look at the Me Too movement, and now that men know that they're not allowed to do certain things in the workplace to women that they used to get away with all the time, men still do it, but they are less likely to do it. We are already seeing that. Now, I know there's unintended consequences. It's complex.
But that's
not a good example of change with high velocity there, don't you think?
I don't.
No.
And the reason I say that is not because I disagree with that. I disagree with the premise that the regulation is what caused that. I think the transparency is what caused that. And I truly believe that transparency fixes a lot of things. When people started coming out with the Me Too movement, shedding light on what's going on, social media has helped people realize what's happening, and people finding out, oh crap, I'm going to get caught. I don't think you need a law at all. I think people see that. They worry about their reputation. They worry about their life being destroyed and that the
law
has nothing to do with it.
I think I disagree with that. most people, if they could get away with just groping women and did not have a legal consequence, would hopefully not do it. But there is a population of people who would still do it, and one of them is the president. And because the law doesn't apply to the president, he has been able to do that. Now, if he were someone who was a mid-level executive and the law applied to him, he'd be in jail.
Mm-hmm.
But over just his interaction with women. But he knows the law doesn't apply to him. However, most mid-level executives, even the ones who would love to be Donald Trump and act that way, don't do it because they know they will go to jail.
You think that their reputation isn't worth it to them to not do it? Transparency to their family.
No, I think that's some of it.
Public,
I think that's some of it.
I don't disagree.
I think that's a component.
That,
what I'm saying is, yeah. I think there's components.
I would agree with that statement that the law can be a deterrent, but I think that transparency is a better deterrent.
Yeah, it's for, in my opinion, I feel the same similar way to you, Andrew. It's, you know, it's someone having their reputation ruined publicly versus, you know, some rich executive who could easily pay the fine or pay the, you know, the girl off to shut up. You know,
okay,
and you know, it's, but he'd rather, you know, he'd pay that fine in a heartbeat rather than have his reputation destroyed.
So is this an argument for having very few laws at all then?
Well, that's kind of the libertarian way, right? To have a smaller government. And many people misconstrue libertarianism for no government, which is not the case.
Yeah,
you know?
No,
that's anarchy.
No.
Yeah, and we're often accused of hating the roads, which isn't true at all.
We love the roads.
The roads in Rochester certainly live quite a bit to desire.
Bridges are good.
Bridges are important.
Excellent.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, in general, the libertarian mindset would be that government is smaller, that there's fewer regulations that allow things like the free market to actually go forward and do what it should do. A lot of people think that we have a free market today. It's not the case because there's so many regulations in place.
Mm-hmm.
We could even talk about vaping. You know, vaping's come up a whole bunch of times where people say, hey, don't you think that vaping should be illegal because maybe there's a health risk? And I don't think so at all, because that's the individual's choice. I think we should still have transparency. If we find a problem where there is a health risk, put on the package the same way you do with alcohol and cigarettes. But I don't think government should be involved in that choice. You know, the end consumer should have the option to know what's best for them and make the choice. Even if it's the wrong choice, it should be their choice, not government's.
Vaping at least shows how inconsistent the government is and what it chooses to make.
Yes, absolutely.
It also shows an emotional reaction to try to ban something that even though they don't have a clue what they're talking about.
One other quick question before we get to listener feedback, which is this. Sean, you mentioned online, and I think your colleague Kevin Wilson agreed with this, that the very act of a confiscation of any firearms, and again, I'm using that term because I'm trying to be intellectually honest here. If there's an AR-15 forced buyback, I think that's a form of confiscation.
It
they
is.
Should be able
Absolutely.
To say it.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
You think any act of confiscation is itself violence?
Yeah. As long if it's... If you're coming at me and threatening me with some kind of violent or punitive measures.
Yeah, you got to pay a fine if you don't hand in your weapon.
Yeah, that's oppression, that's tyranny, that's
violence.
That they're not going to come and tickle me and try to take it.
Yeah. Well, they might. You
know, no, I don't think they're going to come to tickle me.
I don't think tickle.
Yeah.
But I think maybe fine.
Yeah, but what if I don't
sanction in different
again?
Ways?
What if I refuse to pay the fine? What if I think that I feel that the fine is unconstitutional?
I see where you're going, because eventually they're going to incarcerate you.
Eventually they're going to come at me with violence.
Or yeah, and incarceration.
They always do.
Incarceration could be a best case scenario. I mean, think about it. Many people, I feel, don't always look at law and think about what the actual end consequence is. And this is a very raw way to put this, but you know, at the end of just about every law, there's a guy or a girl with a gun at the end of that law. And they will, if you don't follow that law, put you in a cage. And if you won't go in that cage, they will kill you. That's just the reality. And I know people say, oh, that sounds anti-cop. That's not anti-cop. It's the reality of the situation with most laws.
I do understand that framing of it, sure. Do you then think it is logical that when we talk about an AR-15 ban, and again, I know that's clumsy, and I recognize that it would need to be a lot more thoughtful than just ban AR-15s, which is, I'm sure it would be a little different than that. But let's just walk down this road. There is some kind of a ban. Do you agree that there would be a violent backlash, and do you think there should be a violent backlash?
Shall I?
Sean. You can, or I'll take it. Yeah, whatever.
Yes and yes.
You think people should kill members of the government if they try to ban
I didn't say I think they should.
Yeah, I'm asking if you think there should be a violent backlash.
I'm telling you there will be.
Okay.
Not that there should be.
Okay.
All right. And I want to definitely differentiate those two.
I hear that.
I know I have some friends that are Texans, and they say, sure, you can have it when you take it out of my cold, dead hand. You know, and that's their attitude
toward
it. But
do they hear what that sounds like? Because, you know, women who are arguing for their reproductive rights don't say that if you restrict abortion, they're going to come kill the government. Why are gun owners different?
Because people aren't going to come and try to take the woman. You know, they're not going to try to, like, you know, come after her to confiscate the baby or take her and throw her in jail for it.
You think taking control or telling her what she has to do with her body is not a form of violence?
No, it is. That's what I'm saying.
She's not threatening violence and backlash.
She owns her body.
They're marching on Washington.
She owns her body, okay?
Yeah.
And they are protesting the Judeo-Christian ethics that are being shoved into our laws. And rightfully so. I mean, if you feel that you own yourself, then you're libertarian. If you don't feel that you own yourself and that the government owns you, that you fall under the Democrat or Republican.
I'm just saying, I think you probably agree with a lot of women who want to protect their reproductive rights.
Absolutely.
But they are not threatening to shoot up the government if their rights are taken away.
Because
gun owners are.
Because the government's not going to take something from them, like physically take
something. The government
is
going to put something in them. A child. That they would not otherwise have to carry. Well, that's what I'm saying.
No, the child's already there.
The child's there.
But that's kind of maybe it doesn't quite line up. But if I could jump in real quick and give my perspective, I don't think there's going to be violence. There might be a little, and I'll tell you why. And maybe I catch some backlash from this, but that's okay, because it should be said. You know, effectively in the New York State SAFE Act, that was essentially an attempt to ban AR-15s, AK-47s, and a bunch of other firearms that aren't on anybody's list at all. You know what happened in New York? No, nothing. A couple rallies. People in the United States, and I say the United States because my wife is from Europe. I've been there many times. I have this conversation with people while we're there. People in the United States are just extremely comfortable and complacent. And when the government says roll over, ultimately people roll over. That's just the history that we have here in this nation. We had the beginning of our nation was very different. And I think that's what a lot of gun owners hold on to. And to be honest, I think a lot of gun owners like to think that they would stand up to their government the way the founding fathers did. And I'm here to say it live on the air. Most people aren't going to. The vast majority are going to do exactly what happened with the New York SAFE Act, which is New York SAFE Act has a less than 96% compliance rate. 96%. You see very similar numbers with New Jersey when they instituted a similar ban. So is there going to be violence? There wasn't any in New York State. And they estimate that I forget that there are 2 million AR-15s just in New York State that were never registered, never surrendered, never sold out of the state. That's a pretty big chunk considering, you know, the estimated number of AR-15s in the United States is the highest numbers I've seen is 10 million. So we're talking about close to 20% of the AR-15s in the country. The owners chose not to comply with the law and to, instead of inciting violence, creep in the shadows and just hope to God that they don't get arrested and thrown in jail with crimes higher than molesting a child.
I think a lot of rural sheriffs in particular aren't interested in enforcing parts of it. I think a lot of sheriff's departments...
Isn't like 25 counties or something?
There is like a growing non-enforcement movement.
No question.
But I've had conversations with many different law enforcement officers.
All right.
Over the years.
Anyway, you think that'd be somewhat similar if we saw.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
That's fair. Yep. I am way late for our only break. Then we'll get back to your feedback here. You're hearing Andrew Hollister, who's a former candidate for lieutenant governor in the Libertarian Party, a small business owner, an outdoors enthusiast. Sean Phelan is here, Monroe County representative to the Free Libertarian Party of New York, and co-host of Rochester's Liberty Talk Hour on Rochester Free Radio. Back to your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, Joaquin Phoenix is Joker. The film, in theaters now, has sparked a lot of debate. And next hour, we hear from City News film critic Adam Lubitau. We're also going to have a conversation about mental illness as depicted in the film. What does the expert community say about Joker? What do you say? That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Real briefly, Sean, where can people hear you on the radio before we get to our feedback here?
My show is outside the Echo Chamber, and we can be found at rochesterfreeradio.com. Listen live 9 a.m. on Saturday mornings, and again, a replay 7 a.m. on Wednesday mornings. We can also be heard on Spotify, I believe, YouTube. We also have SoundCloud. A lot of different podcasts, but you could also find it outsidetheechochamber.show.
Outsidetheechochamber.show, if you want to check that out. All right, back to the phones we go. Let's get Emma and Shalott first. Go ahead, Emma.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question for the two guests. I was just wondering, and this is not a rhetorical question, why they believe that any single citizen would need an AR-15. I can understand why they'd need a pistol or a rifle or a hunting rifle, but why any single citizen would need something as deadly as an assault rifle? I'm just curious to hear what they have to say on that.
All right, Emma, thank you. And let me preface this for our guest by saying Sean earlier talked about the fact that in his view, an AR-15 or of its ilk, weapons like it, are functional because it's important for homeowners, if they're going to try to protect themselves, to have strong firepower. 22 in his view, small bullets, not nearly enough damage if someone's actually trying to hurt or kill you. Protecting against government tyranny was another reason. So let me reframe hers just a little bit and say, because you brought up a 9mm, which is different than a 22.
Mm-hmm.
Why not carry 9mm at home instead of an AR-15?
There's same reason I wouldn't use a RPG. It's just too much. I'm looking to stop an intruder in my house if they're coming in.
Can't you do it with a 9mm?
It's going to go through them, and it's going to damage whatever is behind them. And, you know, I'm just looking to stop a person. I'm not necessarily, if I was a gun owner, I'm not necessarily looking to kill the person, but I'm looking to stop them.
An AR-15 is going to kill them.
It depends on where you shoot them. I've shot an AR-15, M16, all through the military, and it really depends on where you shoot them.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I don't know if our guests are open to regulation based on bullets. But let me just read this the recent Boston study. And I'm quoting now. A new study published in the journal JAMA Network Open underscores an often overlooked factor in gun policy debate. When it comes to lethality, not all guns are created equal. Analyzing data on hundreds of shootings in Boston, Anthony Braga of Northeastern University and Philip J. Cook of Duke found that on a bullet-per-bullet basis, shootings committed with a large-caliber firearm are much more likely to result in a fatality than those with a smaller-caliber gun. Caliber is a measure of the diameter of the bullets fired by a particular gun. The study analyzed data on 221 gun homicides and 1,012 non-fatal shootings. They found stark differences in shooting outcomes depending on the caliber of gun used, and they divided the calibers of gun used in shootings into three categories: small, which was 22, 25, and 32 calibers; medium, which was 38s, 9 millimeters; and large, which included 40s, 44 magnums, 45s, 10 millimeters, and a few others. And then they then found that, all things being equal, a person shot with a medium caliber weapon, such as a common 9 millimeter, were roughly 2.3 times as likely to die of their wounds than someone shot with a smaller caliber gun, say a 22. And a large caliber gun, AR-15 if you like, 4.5 times as likely to die than someone hit with a 22. We don't dispute that. So, I mean, is that fair to at least analyze that data and say bullets themselves?
Yeah, I'm willing to accept that data without any, you know, debate.
Do you see why people want to write? Okay,
one
go ahead.
Piece of debate.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't realize, and I brought along a nice little chart for you if you want to pass it over.
Okay.
The round that comes out of an AR-15 is a 22 caliber round. So it actually falls in that small caliber category. So when you say, you know, the higher caliber rounds where the AR-15 falls in, it doesn't fall into that. The AR-15 shoots literally the smallest available sized cartridge of rifles in like any scope, basically. The only thing smaller, there's only really two smaller. There's a 17 HMR and the 22 long rifle, which the 22 long rifle is also 22 caliber. So when we talk about high-powered rifles and medium-powered and stuff like that, the things that people hunt with are significantly higher and significantly larger. You know, what you hunt bear with, you could shoot a bear with a 22. He's going to laugh at you and eat you. Yeah. You know, that's a joke in the hunting community, but it's true. Most people won't even hunt deer with an AR-15 because it's such a small round, they think they're going to wound the animal instead of killing it. So I think that when we talk about, you know, why do you need such a high-powered round? It's a relatively small bullet and low-powered round compared to anything. And I would say most homeowners that own a firearm don't even own something that small.
So 9mm bullet, you said it's going to go right through somebody.
Oh, yeah.
It may or may not. It's a higher velocity round. And so something that's missing from the conversation almost always is what's called power factor. The weight and size of the bullet and the velocity of the bullet. You take that, you plug into an equation, you get a power factor.
I'm not a doctor, but I've read accounts of from hospitals after mass shootings with weapons that we might call AR-15 or mm-hmm. some mm-hmm. And the doctors are just crestfallen at their inability to save people because of how devastating those bullets are.
It is.
Okay. So I hear people saying, let's regulate on the bullets used. Are libertarians okay with regulating on the bullets used?
Unfortunately, that is an infringement on the Second Amendment.
No, I think, and we already have this in New York State too, right? They've tried to do that with like 50 caliber size bullets. We're asking the wrong questions. The question should not be, you know, what do we regulate on firearms? The question should be, why do we live in a day and age where students wake up in the morning and think that their only way out of life is to go to school, shoot their peers, and then kill themselves?
Mm-hmm.
The question is not how big of a bullet, what style gun, can it have a pistol grip or not? The question is, why is it that, you know, the AR-15 was put into production in the 1950s, the AK-47 in the 1940s, you know, and many other guns. The gun that I carry for my personal protection was made in 1911, over 100 years ago. So when we look at this, these guns have been around for decades and a century. Why is it that today that we think that regulating that is the answer to the problem instead of taking a look at what's happening with kids? Why do they wake up wanting to kill people?
Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem, Andrew. The other thing is I would like to address your caller to answer their question. Venezuela. That's my answer. Venezuela confiscated all guns in 2012, and by 2019, when the government had collapsed, they were using armored personnel carriers to run over protesters, and we saw the video of it just a few months ago. That's why. Because the government will turn on you eventually. It's done it, you know, Ruby Ridge, Waco, Texas, Kent State University. And I mean, those people were unarmed, and the government people still shot them.
So what is the kind of regulation, if you're in the room with mostly Democrats these days, but people who want different gun laws, is anything on the table? Any law that you would say, this makes sense, let's talk about this. What's on the table?
Repeal the SAFE Act. I'd yeah. support that.
Yeah.
So the answer is no. Yeah. Background checks.
We have them. We've had them for decades. And that's the thing that it bounces around the media all the time. The NICS system has been in place since the 90s.
Licensing, insurance. If your gun is stolen and used to harm others, can you be held responsible?
That's actually a good question. I would ask if somebody steals your car and drives and runs somebody over and your keys were locked in your home, are you responsible? And we should hold everything to the same standard. If as society we decide...
a car's not a gun.
I'd almost...
They do just as much damage, if not more. They kill more people every year.
It's not designed to, though.
But if it's misused, it can do a hell of a damage, you know, to a person, you know, far more than any gun could.
Anything on the table for you, Sean, that you think makes sense?
There's only one thing that I would put on the table, and that would just be for a discussion. All right. And that would be a car has a title tied to it. A gun should have a title tied to it. I'm willing to discuss that, but nothing other than that.
Geez, you sound like a socialist. What do you think, Andrew?
Socialist? I thought we were getting along nice.
I'm a title to it? What do you think?
A title to it? No. I don't have a title to my cell phone. I don't have a title to my computer, my personal property. To be honest, the only reason the only reason that you have a title to your vehicle is so the government can tax you for a vehicle registration and inspection every year. So it's not about safety. It's not about anything other than government control over your property.
I want to thank our guests for elucidating their views on this issue. And you're going to see a lot more conversation on gun policy, not just because of presidential primaries, but this country, I think, is always going to have a conversation about this. And that, in many ways, is the libertarian perspective. From Andrew Hollister and Sean Phelan, thank you for both taking the time to be with us.
Thanks for having us.
Short break. More Connections coming up.